Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM for Monday, December 21st. It is the solstice today, the longest, or rather the shortest day of the year. The exact moment of the solstice was at 2:02 a.m. Vancouver time. So I hope you're celebrating your solstice day in whatever way you do. We have a great show for you today. Coming up in a moment is the roundup of news corona-wise from around the world. Right after that, we have a look at the impact of corona on the music industry here in Vancouver and beyond with music veteran and booker Joelle May. We're going to be talking about the impact this year and what to look forward to in 2021. Front Burner looks at the impact of COVID on suicide lines and the stress it's putting on them there. And on Bird Note, we take a look at the legendary and extinct dodo bird. Here is the world update.
This is the coronavirus global update on Monday, the 21st of December. I'm Alex Ritson. EU leaders try to agree a common response to the spread of a new variant of coronavirus in southern England. Dozens of other countries are enforcing travel bans on the UK. South African scientists are also investigating a new variant, and the US agrees a stimulus package to alleviate COVID-19 hardship. Representatives of European Union countries have been meeting in Brussels to try to coordinate measures to prevent the spread from Britain of what is thought to be a more contagious form of coronavirus. France is enforcing a 48-hour blockade of people from Britain, and many other countries in Europe and elsewhere have suspended flights or put in other travel restrictions. In Germany, some passengers who arrived overnight from Britain are being held in isolation in airports. Sabrina Dinkler-Stem described what happened when her flight from London landed at Hanover Airport.
At Heathrow Airport, no one checked me. No one asked me where I was coming from and where I was going. And then we sat on the plane. It was a normal flight, like I do once a month. We landed, and then I felt like a criminal. I was totally surrounded by the police. I was outside in the rain. We couldn't move because we were stuck with the 70 other passengers.
The French Health Minister Olivier Véran explained why precautions were being taken.
Et là, en l'occurrence, cette variation du virus, elle a été identifiée dans une zone.
This variant of the virus was identified in an area of England where there is a higher circulation of the virus. So English scientists are asking whether this new variant of the virus could be more contagious than the others. They don't have proof, but as they are posing the question, you understand we are taking all the necessary measures.
France has indicated it may lift the 48-hour ban on lorries crossing the Channel from Britain if European Union countries can agree rules on movement from the UK. Gavin Lee is in Brussels.
One of the main options which France are particularly pushing is that if they open their borders soon, they would like to see rapid COVID tests apply to be able to open for freight. And they would have categories of people who could move quickly. So first of all, it would be cross-border workers, including freight drivers, vulnerable and health workers, and then it comes to those sort of lower down the pecking order. So I think that is what we can expect over the Christmas period.
The European Medicines Agency has approved the use of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine against coronavirus in the European Union. It's brought forward its decision by a week following pressure from the German Health Minister, Jens Spahn. Anna Holligan reports.
Rapidly increasing infection rates and tighter lockdown rules have added to the pressure on the EMA to act faster. Deploying an effective and safe vaccination offers the best hope of ending the pandemic. Many countries are hoping to start rolling out their vaccination programmes within days. It's also paramount, the EU body said, to ensure public trust in the vaccine at a time when scepticism and disinformation are rife.
South African scientists say they're working with the World Health Organization to investigate a new variant of the virus that causes COVID-19, currently surging in many parts of the country. It's known as 501V2. From Johannesburg, Pumza Filani.
South Africa's new variant of COVID-19 was discovered earlier this month when scientists noticed a number of mutations during routine surveillance of the virus. Local scientists say that South Africa's new variant appears to be unrelated to the new variant found in the UK, but it does share one important mutation. The shared mutation affects the way the virus attaches to human cells, and scientists speculate that's what's behind the faster transmission of this virus.
A $900 billion coronavirus relief package has finally been agreed by Republicans and Democrats in the US Congress. Peter Bowes reports.
The package will boost unemployment benefits and provide one-off payments of $600 for people earning less than $75,000 a year. That's about 160 million Americans. There are also funds to help small businesses, transport companies, farmers and students. It's the second largest economic stimulus package in US history, following the measure worth $2.3 trillion, which was passed in March.
Thailand's prime minister has said there are no immediate plans for a wider lockdown after a further 382 cases of coronavirus at a seafood centre near Bangkok. Most of the new infections were among migrant workers from neighbouring Myanmar. More than 40,000 people living nearby will be tested. In Japan, the governor of Tokyo, Yuriko Koike, has urged the capital's residents to stay at home during the Christmas holiday to prevent the spread of coronavirus. And that was the coronavirus global update.
Thank you to the BBC for that. In today's weather, and this week's weather, today rain at times heavy except for some wet snow over higher elevations. Today maybe about 25 millimeters of snow over higher areas. Windy near the water this afternoon. Temperatures steady at +4. Tonight lots of rain, but things are clearing overnight and we're looking for some sunny days. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday this week with the rain returning on Christmas Day. That also means perhaps snow on some higher elevations and up on the ski hills. That'll continue through the weekend. So not a bad week overall. You might want to plan, if you got some time off, to get outdoors and take advantage of that sun while you can. This year has been a really rough year for the live music industry. One of the first industries to shut down completely, and probably one of the last industries to return. On Friday, I talked to music industry veteran Joelle May. She's a fixture here in Vancouver and has worked for many years promoting and representing live music here in Vancouver, one of the people who makes that happen here, not only here, but across Canada. On Friday, I talked to her about the impact of COVID this last year on live music and what we can expect for 2021.
So last time we talked, was way back in maybe the end of March or the early April when the pandemic was getting started. Do you remember what you were feeling back then?
Back then, you know, it was a lot more, like we really thought it was going to be a lot more temporary. We thought that the shutdowns were going to be, you know, a few months and that maybe it was going to be a difficult year, but that, you know, surely by the end of the year, at least, that things would be fine, you know, and it would be in the distant past by then, which certainly hasn't proven to be the case. It was scary. It was really scary at the beginning, but, you know, we were looking at China and things like that and going, okay, they're opening back up again 2-3 months later. That's probably all it's going to take for us. Boy, were we wrong.
I mean, one of the things we talked a lot about at that time, and I think it's still a big issue for the industry, is just how many people were put out of work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think in some ways the industry has adapted in some ways, but certainly not in ways that are putting people really back to work in any meaningful way. What are you hearing from your colleagues and other people in the industry just about how challenging that is for people?
Well, you know, I think a lot this year we had a lot of events that we, you know, the smaller events that we could have. And I think a lot of them were just sort of to try to get production people and things like that, the other people who work in the business, not just the artists and whatnot, a little bit of work throughout the week, like, you know, drive-in concerts and hotel balcony concerts and things like that. They're not sustainable models really for the future. They're not really money-making ventures for the promoters and for the artists and whatnot. They make a little bit, but it's not really sustainable. But at least there was a few of those things to keep some of those people in work this year, you know. And sadly, I've seen a bunch more that have, you know, that are getting other jobs, you know, or they're like driving delivery in the meantime or things like that, you know, which is sad. I really want them to get back to work. I think,
yeah, you know, especially when you work in such a fun industry, you know, and for many people, you know, to be part of this is, you know, is often a sort of a dream. And then sort of punt it out all of a sudden. I mean, hopefully, you know, things will come back, but it's got to be hard on people.
Well, I'm sure that there'll be, you know, that, and there'll be people that do come back, and there'll be people that we lose forever, unfortunately, out of that if they get something else. And, you know, a lot of the skills, I guess, that, that these folks have, you know, they are very transferable to other jobs and whatnot, but it's hard to convey that, I guess, how transferable they are, you know. But I guess once they get into it, you know, you never know. We might lose a few, but...
So since the spring, I mean, we're now 9 months into it, and we can certainly see how, you know, artists and the industry are trying to evolve into something that works with some of the stuff you mentioned, like some of the, you know, balcony concerts and drive-in concerts. Obviously nothing on the scale of, you know, 5 nights a week of live music in a venue, much less dozens of venues across the city. What are the kind of changes you're seeing in terms of how people in the industry are able to operate?
I'm seeing a lot of innovation is sort of the big word that I would use. Innovation and diversification. I think we all, like everybody who works in the industry, was sort of forced this year to become an expert in something that maybe that they had nothing to do with previously. You know, online shows became quite a thing. And, you know, I know myself, I've got a heck of a lot more video skills than I did at the beginning of this year. Not that I necessarily, you know, want to become a live streaming video show kind of person or anything like that, but it's good to have those skills. And I've also seen, like, you know, live booking agencies, you know, of course, have been very hard hit at venues and agencies and things like that. And I'm seeing them innovate a lot of different things. Like the Rickshaw Theater here in Vancouver has been doing streamed concerts and recording, you know, renting itself out for recordings for videos and things like that. You know, and it's making ends meet, it seems, you know, it's sort of humping along there. But, you know, and my own company at Sakamoto Agency, we're going to be expanding some services in the new year, you know, outside of just live booking services. You know, and we've been lucky also to have some government support throughout this year for sure. That's helped keep us alive. And also positioned us better to be able to pull off these innovations and make some changes and try something new, you know, and that's what I think everybody in the music industry, if you've worked in it for the last decade or so, at least you've seen things change a lot already. And you're constantly having to innovate. And so, you know, we didn't really want to do this one, but we can do it, you know.
Do you think, I mean, some of these will carry on after. I mean, obviously it's going to be very exciting for everyone, fans and people working in the industry when we can finally get back to going to live shows. But, you know, some of the stuff, you know, I mean, and one of the things I've seen, you know, particularly later this fall, because initially a lot of the shows were just, let's get together and put out a show. And now we're starting to see where bands are charging an admission price, so to speak, which is great for them. You get some, you know, be able to make some money. Do you see those things like that carrying on as an alternative? I mean, one of the things, yeah, you know, here in Vancouver, of course, a zillion and one bands will come through town and we get to see them. If you're not in Vancouver, mm-hmm, that's not necessarily, it's not as accessible. And maybe this is an option that can maybe make that accessible beyond the big centers.
I think that's what, it's like the question on everybody's mind right now is, how is that going to translate once we get live shows back? And I think that there's going to be a measure of things that totally dies off, you know, like a drive-in show. Mm-hmm. You know, why would you do that once you can gather again, leave the cars in the parking lot, come to the show. But the online thing and monetization of online stuff, that's, you know, that's sort of the ongoing battle. And I think that we will find a place to make that, you know, last beyond this and have it as an option. Like you said, people who are not as accessible to big cities, say, they can, you know, have a streaming price to stream into a big concert in the city, say, and things like that. There's, but I think we have to be really careful about where we go with that, because at what point does it just become a live concert DVD?
Yeah.
You know, like, which we've already, we know and we have been doing for years. You know, I had one person who brought up recently, like, oh, we need to get Netflix in on this. And I was like, well, Netflix, you can already watch a lot of concerts on Netflix, you know? And, you know, so there has to be that live streamed, that some sort of unique element to it that makes it more than just watching a concert on a screen.
So are people exploring ways to make the events more interactive? Because that's one of the options, yeah, that sort of the online platform does, is create a sort of degree of interactivity. Like, yeah, certainly it's going to be less than the interactivity of a live show, but more than just watching a recording, you know.
Yeah,
we all know that, you know, as good as they can be, you know, a concert documentary still pales, you know, compared to the actually being there.
Absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, there's more elements you can do with it, with live streams and stuff like that. You can have your Q&A sessions and interviews and things like that, and a lot more direct interaction with fans, as opposed to just, yeah, watching it. You know, potentially there's contest opportunities, or, you know, any number of things that you could, mm-hmm, that you could build into that. We'll see, though. I mean, it's going to be, the market will dictate what it wants ultimately. You know, we try a bunch of things and throw them at it, see what sticks.
So for this year, obviously there's been an awful lot of downers, particularly on the music front. Mm-hmm. Have there been some highlights for you? Things that were maybe unexpected?
God, I wish I had a quick answer to that. You know, we have had some triumphant moments for sure. At Sakamoto Agency, where I work, we have done one thing that's been really fulfilling throughout this year, is that we started taking all of the recorded content that we have from this year, from many bands and things like that. And we started just on a volunteer basis delivering that content to care homes, and getting, you know, giving entertainment to seniors and those infirmed who are in care homes and whatnot. And that's been really rewarding. It's picked up pretty quickly, and it's of course, because all those people have lost their entertainment too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we wanted to do something to give back. So we started doing that. We called it the 100 Homes Concert Connections Initiative. And that's been really lovely. We've also had, you know, a few things that have really worked out like that, like the Washboard Union just did a call, a Zoom call with a bunch of students and members of the staff at a school in Colorado, of all places, that the superintendent of the schools had discovered one of their songs online on a workout playlist, I think, when she was working out, and she found it inspirational as the song Shine, and sort of made it the theme song for the school for the year. And so, you know, the Washboard Union just zoomed into a little performance and Q&A for a bunch of students in a school, and, you know, students are in their masks in their classroom dancing, and it was, you know, like, it was pretty amazing. It was pretty inspiring. So, you know, there's still that direct reach out to fans you can still do, which is, I'm pretty happy you can at least maintain that. Can you imagine if we'd been going through this prior to the advent of the internet?
Oh man, I think of that all the time. I can imagine what it was like to be in the pandemic of 1919, where,
yeah,
I mean, a lot of people didn't even have telephones.
Nope. You had to write letters to your friends, you know.
Now that we've started to see the arrival of vaccines, you know, there's sort of, we can still distantly see the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm wondering, for your industry, are you getting any extra information or advice from government or health agencies about that will help you with your planning? Because, I mean, a lot of what you do has a long lead time.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've seen with how hard it's been to predict the way things go, you know, it's difficult to start making plans for 6 or 8 months out without any information. Are you getting help?
A little, for sure. You know, I'm lucky that Paul, who I work with, has some relationships in government there, and he has been able to get some extra information and whatnot. Mostly we do have just sort of what the rest of the public has, and in talking with the rest of, you know, and we discuss regularly with the rest of the industry what they're doing, what information they're getting. It's one thing that's definitely brought the industry together. You know, there's been a lot of discussion amongst the music industry across Canada, and sharing of information. And we're optimistic now. We, like you say, we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. Vaccines are coming, and I'm hoping that as soon as the holiday break is done and we go back in January, that things will really start happening, because, like you say, we are booking, you know, 6-8 months out in advance. We're booking, you know, I mean, we've already booked some 2022 shows,
right,
throughout this year, and rebooked everything from 2020 into 2021, and now we're gonna have to tackle that again.
Yeah.
Not looking forward to that in January, but you know, that's, there's gonna be I think some semblance of live music in 2021. What that exactly looks like yet, I'm not 100% sure. I think reasonably we can expect a summer similar to what we had, with a few small shows and different things going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think going into the fall, we'll be able to go back to actually attending shows and hopefully not having to wear masks and whatnot when we do.
Well, that will be exciting, and it's certainly, I think, something for all.
Yeah.
Fans.
Hey, if I have to wear a mask at a concert, though, I will. I will happily wear a mask to go see the concert. Get my vaccine and take my mask too.
Yeah. Just,
you know, yeah. Get me in front of the stage. Excellent. Or behind the stage, which is also my very comfortable place to be.
So it is almost the end of the year. So I'm just going to ask you, what do you have any favorite music releases? Because, I mean, there was a big pause sort of for a while, but things were, in terms of new releases, really started to ramp up. You know, bands putting stuff out into the summer and into the fall.
Yeah.
You have any favorites from among what you've been seeing and hearing?
This year, we started to hear, and I've had some involvement in this, but a band from the past called Connelline Crush, a Canadian band. You know, some Canadian royalty. They've started re-releasing some new music. And, you know, we've seen a bunch of people put out albums and stuff like that. And I feel for them, because I'm like, oh, you can't do the whole business of it, you know, with following up with shows and whatnot. I really liked the new, oh gosh, why is her name escaping me? The Fiona Apple album that came out this year. That was a good one. Honestly, I feel like personally, I probably didn't discover as much new music this year as I normally would. I think obviously because there's less of it coming out, but just that not having the interaction sort of, it was like it cut off certain places for me to go and discover things too, you know, and I can't spend my life scouring the internet for it. It's just personally, that's, it's not my favorite thing to do, you know, but yeah, I look forward to discovering way more new stuff next year.
I wonder if the analogy of what seems to be happening with movies, where, you know, big major releases come out, but they're only released streaming, and they sort of come up and then they disappear really quickly. They don't sort of, you know, how like a blockbuster normally comes up and it's all the promo and people go to the film, and it somehow it sort of translates into the broader discussion. And that doesn't happen with movies. And I wonder if it's the same thing with music, where bands come putting up their record and, you know, they do the promo and whatnot and get a little attention, but then because they're not on the road, because they're not spending 4 or 5 months or whatever, you know, actively promoting it, whether they sort of come up and get a little flurry of activity and then it dies down again.
And then you completely run out of things. Yeah, that's exactly what we've seen this year is, you know, it's like you're missing out on a large part of the product. Mm-hmm. You know, and going to live shows, and a large part of the promotion, really, because you have to have a product in order to promote, right? Whether that be an album or a show, really, I mean, you kind of need them in tandem with each other, you know. And I've definitely noticed that it was like things, you know, maybe they seem to come out of the gates really strongly, but yeah, it just like it stopped quickly, you know. It ended fast, and people forgot about it. And I think everybody's been pretty sort of insular and paying attention to their own world this year, mm-hmm. More than really looking out there, because, you know, when we look out there, it's a lot of shit to look at, really. Sorry.
Okay, well, what do you...
And I just mean in general, not musically. I mean, you know, I just mean bad news.
Yeah.
That, you know, that you look out there and you see a lot of bad news, so maybe you avoid that. You avoid consuming new stuff that comes through, because, you know, we're all just sort of trying to maintain.
Okay, so what things seem to be shifting? What are you looking forward to most for the coming year, both the short term and the long term, in terms of?
I am looking forward to just actually getting back to doing my regular job. Like, I can't wait until I just have busy, busy days again, you know, until I'm like anxious to get out of bed and get it started again, because I know I'm going to do fun, exciting, good things, you know, and that, sure, I'll probably end up making a lot of phone calls and filling out a lot of spreadsheets too. But, you know, when you have the passion for it, it's a pleasure to do that sort of thing. And I really want that back. You know, it's been a bit of a slog. That's an understatement, really, to say it's been a bit of a slog. It's been a real big slog this year, just to get through it and to try to, you know, keep positive and keep innovating and everything like that. So I really look forward to getting back to shows in the short term. You know, I look forward to, after having a nice little break over the holidays, I just look forward to reconnecting with all the team, you know, and all the people across the country and whatnot. I just, miss them.
I know that feeling. Okay, well, let's hope that the fall of 2001 brings us live music again. I know everyone I know can't wait for those days when we can gather together with a beer and some music to listen to with our friends.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or, you know, dance barefoot in front of the stage at a big grassy music festival or something like that.
That would be awesome. You know?
Or I'm wearing my Refuse shirt because this is the last show that I went to before everything shut down. So, and I remember telling you when I did that interview earlier in the year, you know, a year from now or by the end of the year, we'll be singing a different tune. You know, maybe we're not quite there, but we're on the way.
Yeah, we can see the day.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You know, and I think, you know, we've been given the news that by September, we expect to have, you know, all of Canada vaccinated. And I think that it might be optimistic, but I think honestly that could happen sooner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got, I think they're being conservative in saying that. I'm hoping they're being conservative in saying that. And I think that once we get a few more vaccines out on the market, you know, a couple different types coming out there, that things are going to speed up a lot. And I think that we will see a gradual opening, but I think it will, you know, it'll be like the opening of a flower, starts out fast or starts out slow, and then boom, suddenly it's there.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's something to hope for this year.
Fingers crossed.
Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks so much, Magnus.
And look forward to seeing you at a show.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, hopefully 2021, if not definitely in 2022.
For sure.
That was longtime veteran of the live music industry, Joelle May. She works here in Vancouver for the Sakamoto Agency and has been involved in the promotion and publicity sort of side and booking of live music for a long, long time here in Vancouver. It's glad to see that we might be seeing live music return even before the end of 2021. Let's all keep our fingers crossed and hope for that. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM, coming to you from the top of Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, BC. My name is Magnus Thiebold. Coming up in just a few minutes is Front Burner, where they'll be taking a look at the stress COVID-19 and lockdowns and restrictions have placed on suicide prevention lines. But first, here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Of all the bird species driven to extinction in recorded history, at least 90% have been island dwellers. And amongst them, possibly the most famous is the dodo. Nearly 400 years ago, on the island of Mauritius, Portuguese sailors were the first Europeans to lay eyes on this odd, flightless bird. The stocky gray-blue dodo weighed up to 45 pounds, walked on short, thick legs, and sliced open tough-skinned fallen fruit with an enormous hooked bill. Ornithologists have since learned that the dodo was descended from pigeons similar to the ground-dwelling tooth-billed pigeons of present-day Samoa in the South Pacific. Its song is unknown. By the early 1600s, Dutch sailors were provisioning their ships on Mauritius, slaughtering dodos as fast as they could find them. Hunting, together with the introduction of pigs and monkeys to the island, meant the flightless, ground-nesting dodo's days were numbered. By 1690, the dodo was extinct. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. To learn how you can join fellow bird lovers in conservation, visit birdnote.org and help bring birds back.
Hi, I'm Elaine Chow. I'm one of the producers on Front Burner. I'm filling in for Jamie today. We've got a special episode for you. It takes you inside the world of crisis line workers in this country. And with the pandemic, the number of people who need their help has skyrocketed. If you're one of those people, you can call the Canadian Suicide Prevention Service at 1-833-456-4567. 1-800-799-8866. Here's the show.
They'd called in really upset, very high emotions, and they had talked about how they're not feeling safe. They're not feeling safe within their own home. They're wanting to move, but then there's this financial aspect. But I think the thing that really kind of made me hurt with them was they kind of talked at the beginning on how well they were doing with their mental health, how much work they put in, and to see them in such, you know, and hear them in such a low place. It really hurt me to think about.
That's Hannah Storrs from Distress Center Calgary. She helps people in crisis get the help they need.
We definitely have seen an increase in suicide calls, more than we've seen compared to last year. And so while you may be used to kind of getting the odd one here or there, we're seeing it more consistently.
And since the pandemic started, calls to the center have gone way up. Last month, they got 73% more suicide-related calls than they did in the same month last year. Hannah has also noticed that the calls can be more intense. Across the country, people are under more financial pressures. A lot of people are now stuck at home, and they don't actually feel safe there. Crisis Services Canada says calls to the Suicide Prevention Hotline between August and October increased 159% compared to last year. Today, we take you to a crisis call center in Vancouver that's working to meet those needs. This is Front Burner. It's a bit after 5 p.m., and I'm waiting to talk to Max Haberstroh. He just started his shift at the Crisis Center of BC.
And I volunteer both in a crisis response role and in a training, or what we call monitoring role.
And how are you doing tonight, Max?
I'm doing well. I'm excited to do this.
Tonight, I'm checking in with Max while he's on an actual shift taking calls. Max also works at the CBC, and we actually used to be part of the same newsroom.
You really want to come in with a clean attitude because, honestly, if you've had a stressful day, it makes it more difficult for you to be empathetic toward the people who are calling. And that's, you know, aside from risk assessment and safety planning, that empathy and connection is the most important thing that we do. So aside from the mechanical pieces, there's definitely like this emotional preparation that's involved as well.
As soon as Max gets in, he checks in with a staff member who's in charge of overseeing any high-risk calls that come in. Volunteers are set up with a phone that has about 25 lines. They also use instant messaging to stay in touch with each other while they're on calls. So think of it as pretty much a built-in support network.
There's everything that we would need. It's all very close to hand in terms of the things that would help us address a huge variety of callers and help them.
Max, I'll let you go and start taking some calls, and we'll check in a bit later.
All right, that sounds great.
And there's always a wide range of calls, from ones about anxiety and loneliness to ones that are critical. Max told me about a call like that.
It was somebody on, I believe it was the Burrard Bridge, who was calling from one of those bridge phones, which are there specifically for people contemplating jumping. And they were just in total hysterics. Like they were sobbing through the phone. It was tough for them to form a sentence. And at that point, I was aware that one of our other call takers had spoken to him earlier in the night and that they had contacted police. And it, really your job at that moment is just to keep them on the phone as long as is humanly possible, to give emergency responders as much time to arrive as they can get. And at a certain point, he just stopped responding. And I thought that he had jumped. And it turned out later that the police had made contact with him and that he was all right. But there was a couple minutes there where I thought I had just listened to someone die. And that was definitely one where I needed to check in with myself afterwards. The way I'd handle it was I just kind of went, I found a little quiet spot in the center. I had a cry and then went back to work because there was still some shift left. So I didn't reach out to staff for that. They're always available for that kind of thing. That for me, that just wasn't what I needed in that moment. But yeah, it's that's one that I had to check in on with myself for sure.
Making sure that people are safe is a really key part of what Max and his colleagues at the center do. And with the pandemic, so many people are feeling unsafe because they may have gotten evicted or they're trapped at home. Research shows that women in Canada have been dealing with more serious and more frequent domestic violence since March. But helplines don't only deal with high-risk situations. Often it's about listening and trying to understand when someone is struggling in their day-to-day life. Nicole Russo is also checking in with me throughout the night. She's a distress services room support worker. When someone at the crisis line needs to debrief a situation, they talk to Nicole. She got in around the same time as Max and is about an hour into her shift when I first talked to her.
So the call that I just had came through and it was from someone that has never called before. And they were sort of immediately looking for resources for some things that they've been going through recently with their mental health. It was something that they haven't really talked to anybody about thus far, aside from one close friend. And they were just really unsure of what some of their own thinking was meaning, what some of their own behavior was meaning. And it sounded like sort of over the course of this year, they were starting to really feel like they didn't recognize themselves very much anymore. And so they were just hoping to be proactive and to start being able to figure out what some of that might mean. While we were eventually able to get to that point closer to the end of the call, and I was able to offer a couple of resources that they could start with to reach out to and see what that long-term support might look like. But for a majority of the call, in the middle of it, we were just chatting, talking about how this year has been for them, just kind of how their own mental health has been, how they've seen it change and adapt. Not always a negative, but just so much change. I think that's really something that came through in this call and in so many others.
Lately, Nicole has noticed more first-time callers. The center, like so many across the country, has seen an uptick during the pandemic. In April, they went from taking around 110 calls a day to often more than 200. And with COVID concerns, it was hard to keep volunteers who are really the backbone of the service. But thanks to additional funding from the province, the center was able to hire 30 crisis service responders to meet this new need. Fast forward to now, in the second wave of the pandemic, and the increase in calls have kept up. This trend isn't just playing out in BC, it's playing out across the country. Provincial governments are recognizing that the pandemic is having a deep impact on the mental health of so many Canadians. Late last week, Ontario added $147 million to expand services. Nova Scotia is also funding more mental health support. According to a national survey this month from the Canadian Mental Health Association, 40% of Canadians say their mental health has gotten worse since March. 1 in 10 Canadians have thought about suicide recently, up from 2.5% pre-pandemic. That's a huge increase. Max told me that the pandemic has this indirect, all-encompassing impact on the calls he gets. It's not like people are calling in to bring up COVID out of nowhere, but it's about how the virus and the public health restrictions that come with it have really made the struggles that they had before much worse.
It's more like it's an influencer in bigger situations, like situations that kind of were teetering before if they're happening in the pandemic, that might be what pushes those situations over the edge. It kind of exacerbates things that were already there. I would say that's the most common way that it makes its way in.
It's almost that emotions are really heightened at this time.
Yeah. It ratchets up whatever else seems to be going on. It adds to already volatile situations and pushes them, you know, past the breaking point in some cases.
It's about 7 p.m. at this point, and Max and I are doing our second check-in of the night.
I took three. I think the most serious was a woman who called in saying that her father was being just very aggressive emotionally and unfair towards the rest of the family. It sounds like he had pretty consistently been an emotionally dominating person.
The woman that Max was just talking about there, she's working through a lot of strain between different family members, and she's really worried that her father might hurt himself. Calls like that feel really relatable right now, when so many families are under stress, whether that's emotional or financial. Nicole says that she's also noticed that a lot of people are just feeling isolated.
Maybe COVID has made life a lot more difficult, or maybe it's affected your financial security, or you're living alone and you're not able to see or talk to anybody without fear of getting sick. And there's just so much need for connection right now. And I'm seeing that through all of the calls that we're getting.
Listening to people in this moment, and whether it's dealing with their anxiety or their loneliness, has it made you reflect differently on the pandemic yourself?
I think for me, I definitely do feel that all of us are sort of connected in the fact that we're all affected by COVID in some way, shape, or form. And I think what the biggest part of that is, and the biggest difficulty in it, really is the isolation. Losing that face-to-face interaction, and sometimes losing the voice-to-voice interaction if everything's over email, that I think people start to feel a little lost. And it just becomes that much harder to reach out and say that you're struggling or that you're suffering, because everybody is. And I think that is one of the big things that I've been noticing and feeling, and even in myself as well, the idea that so many of us don't want to burden others with the things that we're going through right now, because we know that they're also going through other things, or maybe the same things. And so there can sometimes be a fear of adding to the weight on someone else's shoulders if you bring up yourself or your own struggles. But in my personal experience, whether it's here at the center or just in my regular life, I find that those moments of connection about struggle can be the most profound, and you can really find your people.
Okay, at this point, you're probably sick and tired of my voice, but how are you?
Sorry, what was the question?
How's it going?
Oh, it's going fine. I just went through a kind of classic crisis center experience, which is, you know, the first half of that call-taking time was, you know, fairly busy. I was doing call after call after call, and then this one, there wasn't a lot happening. And it is often quite streaky like that. Just as you kind of do enough shifts, you kind of see it all in terms of the level of need from people who are calling.
It's a bit past 8 o'clock now, and the night is starting to wrap up. On an average shift, Max says he takes about 12 to 15 calls. He tells me that suicide prevention calls are always prioritized, and if they're not answered at the BC Crisis Center, they get rerouted to another. Max says the volunteers and staff try to answer as many calls as they can as they're coming in. But sometimes when they're overwhelmed, calls do go to voicemail and they get priority later.
There are people who, for whom we're part of their regular mental health routine. There are a lot of people that we talk to every day, sometimes multiple times a day. And of course, we're always looking with them for risk that might not have been there on their prior calls. But knowing which calls require that extra time and that extra safety checking and which calls are less safety focused really helps us kind of move through and help as many people as we possibly can in a shift.
And I suppose it makes sense that there is such a range given the service is very accessible, right? Like there's not a whole lot that's available that's like that. You make a phone call and that's it. It's low barrier is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And for me, it's one of my favorite parts of the service we provide. There are truly no wrong reasons to call. I talk to a lot of people who are getting in touch for the first time and they're like, hey, can I just talk to you? I just had a really rough day. Is that an okay reason for me to call? And the answer is absolutely yes. We're here for everybody.
You know, I was saying to Nicole that something that strikes me in talking to you, talking to her and your colleagues is that, you know, there is this very measured and analytical approach that you guys take to talking about some very difficult things. And I wonder if there's something in there about, there might be some advice in there in helping people kind of process their own challenges, because I seem to hear that from you guys.
I think about like what I talked about earlier. When I talked to somebody who, you know, I thought for a moment had jumped off a bridge, it's whether it's that or any other struggle that comes up as a result of the phone lines. It's like for me, it's acceptance. It's not fighting that feeling. It's not putting yourself in a place where you're saying, I shouldn't be feeling this way, or I need to change the way that I'm feeling actively. Acceptance and acknowledgement works, I think, internally as much as it does when you're talking to other people who are going through struggle.
It's like it's a delicate balance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, if you're that, yeah, the idea that I have to be feeling your feelings in order to support you, I think is a dangerous one for somebody in this role. I think any call taker can empathize very effectively in a way that is healing for the person on the other side without feeling those things internally. And you're right. It is absolutely a maintenance of that balance where you're close enough to put yourself in that other person's shoes, but not so close that you are feeling those feelings yourself. I think what you're seeking is genuine understanding as opposed to genuine experience of their emotions for yourself.
This is really rigorous work. Volunteers and staff at the BC Crisis Center have to go through months of training. And for many, like Nicole, they've come to this work in part because of their own personal experiences.
My own father really suffered with depression and just his own mental health. And when I was 18, he ended up taking his life. He died by suicide. And it was obviously life-changing. And he and I did not have a very, very close relationship before that point. It was off and on, as that can be. And it was still devastating. It was still something that really opened up a lot of questions for me about his life, about our relationship, about my own mental health, and what was coming for me down the road and what that could look like. And if I would ever feel the way he's ever felt. And there was a lot of learning there for me.
Nicole doesn't bring that backstory into her work. Responders are discouraged from sharing about their lives because they want to focus on the caller's needs. But the work is always about making a human connection. And there seems to be something unique about doing that on the phone.
Here at the center, we talk to people via phone calls through a number of different lines that we answer, as well as two types of chat that we also answer online, the regular crisis center chat and the Youth in BC chat. There is a moment where volunteers need to think about the difference of talking to somebody on the phone versus typing to somebody in a chat box. And truly, just the other night, I was here working a DSRS shift, and one of our volunteers took a chat that was with a young teenager, and they had chatted with us before, actually previously in the same day. It was the second time they were reaching out over chat, and things had gotten worse. Self-harm was involved. Thoughts of suicide were very much involved in the first chat. And by the time we took the second chat, which was only maybe a couple hours later, things had escalated and her risk was much higher. And one of the things that we can do in that moment, if the person is open to it and comfortable with it, is that we can actually transfer the conversation from the chat medium to the phone medium. And I've seen a number of times over the years how that can be a really pivotal moment in that connection. And that was what happened the other night as well, was the teenager was kind of replying with, yeah, okay, I don't know. And it can be really difficult to support somebody when they just don't have a lot to say. And as soon as we were able to connect the volunteer and the chatter on the phone, the conversation just opened up. And you're able to hear people's tone of voice. You're able to hear if someone's crying, and if they're crying quietly or if they're sobbing. You can tell people's breathing. You can hear what they have going on in the background, if they have pets, if they're listening to music. And it is so much more personal and intimate in a way to hear somebody's live voice on the other end of the phone. You can really feel them there.
That young woman was able to connect with the care she needed that night through the crisis line. And right now, there's a push to make it easier for others across the country to do the same. Around a week ago, MPs unanimously passed a motion that would launch a 3-digit national suicide hotline number, 988, to make it simpler for people in crisis to reach out. The CRTC will hold public consultations on that proposal in the new year. If you're listening to this and you're in crisis, there is help for you. You can call 1-833-456-4566 across the country. And to find resources in your area, you can dial 211. I'm Elaine Chow. Jamie Poisson will be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Front Burner.
CJSF 90.1 FM wishes you a bright winter solstice.
And that is our show for today. Thank you for listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. And thank you to our guest today, Joelle May, and also Front Burner and the World Coronavirus Update. My name is Magnus Thiebold. We'll be back on the air tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Lots more great programming coming up here on CJSF later today. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!, Wandering Rhythms up at noon, and typically Tuesdays up at 3 p.m.
The art of the mixtape is not lost. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.
Hey,
This is Anuki, your Faculty of Environment representative, here to let you know what the SFSS is. The SFSS is a student union that is student-led, and it represents and advocates for the interests of the 26,000 undergraduate students at SFU. We are a non-for-profit support network and a voice at SFU, which provides services like the UPass and health and dental. We also provide support to make your student life better. You can reach the SFSS on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or by emailing us. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you.